arrived, I'm going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. And the first item on the agenda is House File 1223. Representative Hilty was just here. Now, where did he go? There he is. He's still here. You're up, Representative Hilty, too, so try to keep the autographs to a minimum.
I will, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1223 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to State Government Finance Division.
Okay.
So Mr. Chair, there is an amendment. I think it's in package.
Is it the A1?
Yes.
Representative Hill, do you want to move your amendment?
Yes, I would move the adoption of the H1223A1 amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Hill, we do not have a quorum yet, so we can move it, but I can't take official action on it. But
very well.
Representative Anderson, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, I just have a couple of questions I was hoping you could clarify for me as I'm reading through this morning. First, on the page 1 on line 1.5, you have it limited to just public post-secondary institutions. Can you tell me why just public?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't believe that it is limited to public. It's public post-secondary institutions and all private post-secondary institutions that are subject to.
Mr. Chair.
Chapter Representative Anderson.
136
to 141. Perhaps I'm missing that. I guess I'm looking at the amendment, A1, line 1.5, and all it says is all public post-secondary institutions. Oh, I see it. Now I do. All right, thank you.
All right, Representative Anderson, that's clarification.
And then just...
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just had one more question. Could you just walk me through a little bit? I was going through the photo identification portion of it. And if I'm correct, if a student were to come to the polling place on Election Day, they would need to provide a photo identification plus something that states their current address. Is that correct?
Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is correct.
Okay, and that could be done either through a driver's license or a utility bill.
Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes. And part of what is being accomplished here is expanding the definition of utility bill, because in the past, it has not been possible to use some of the documentation that many young people are most likely to have, like a cell phone bill rather than a wired telephone bill. And there was an issue that arose in the 2006 election regarding the ability of a student to verify address in a residence where the utilities were paid by the landlord, which is why we're including lease in this language. It's just mainly clarifying and sort of simplifying what means of documentation would be used.
Thank you.
Any further questions to Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this... Does the amendment have the piece, I'm trying to look through it too, real quickly, regarding the challengers?
Representative Hill, this is a rather long amendment. Answer that question. Why don't you just walk us through the amendment and the changes?
I will, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that I believe is in House File 1 or 1110, which is on the agenda for tomorrow.
Representative Hilton.
Yes, I should explain, Mr. Chair. The amendment actually, Mr. Gehring, I think, appropriately sort of redrafted. The amendment to 1223 is actually fairly short, just the number of words that were being inserted. But rather than go through piece after piece and changing, you know, one word here and there, Mr. Gehring just redrafted the first two sections of the amendment to incorporate that. So actually, they're not very much different from the original bill. I can describe the changes if you would like.
Representative Hilly, why don't you do that? And then since you're substituting a good portion of the bill, it might not be a bad idea to describe what you're doing with the bill as you're describing the amendment. Then we do two things at once. We very seldom do that, but multitasking does work.
Works for me, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Sorted out. On the original bill, on page 2, line 2, what we were inserting after the third V, state or city general. On page 2, line 5, we're deleting must be. On line 6, page 2, line 6, deleted everything before the second D and inserted shall be determined by. On page 2, line 15, after A, inserted Minnesota. On page 2, line 29, after the semicolon, inserted and. On page 2, we deleted lines 30 and 31. On page 2 of line 32, deleted 5 and inserted 4. On page 2, line 34, deleted lease, inserted rent statement. On page 3, line 8, deleted Social Security and inserted 4 lease.
Representative Hilkey, Mr. Gehring is going to go through some of the substantive changes, so why don't we let him walk us through those. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, so the as Representative Hilkey pointed out, there's a whole list of sort of one or two word changes in this amendment, and sort of substantively the changes in Section 1, the changes substantively change the law, the bill, so that the format of the list provided to the Secretary of State is determined by the Secretary of State, so that's the effect of all these word changes. And there's some other technical changes just to improve the clarity, as an attempt to improve the clarity of the section. So, for example, on line 13, we say subject to Chapter 136A or 141 rather than regulated by. But the primary change in Section 1 is that the Secretary of State determines the format of the student list that they submit, that is to be submitted to the Secretary. In Section 2 of the bill, we change the language so that a photo ID from an educational institution must be from a Minnesota educational institution rather than any educational institution. The definition of utility bill has been changed to include an itemized rent statement rather than an itemized lease. And as in paragraph B2, where we're talking about the different ways a person can prove the residence, there's the option to present a photo ID and a current utility bill or lease, which is a change. Previously, it allowed the option of presenting a photo ID and a social security statement or other governmental document. And so we took out the possibility of presenting a social security statement or other governmental document as a way to prove your residence. And there's also some minor technical changes attempting to improve the clarity.
Thank you, Mr. Garing. Representative Hilty, we have a quorum. Members, Representative Hilty has moved the A1 amendment, and to put the bill in the form that the author wishes, I realize there may be continued discussion, but let's put the amendment into the bill. So Representative Hilty renews his motion on the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The amendment passes. Representative Hilty, now to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as Mr. Garing described, I think the first two sections are pretty much as he described. What we're doing is clarifying how and by whom the residential housing list is created prior to the election. This would be for student housing. The next section, as Mr. Garing described, and as I mentioned earlier, clarifies and changes some of the requirements for proof of residence on election day. And then the third section deals with the question of residential staff and residential facilities. It defines, and this is just sort of moving language around, defines what a residential facility is, and then changes how the law has read regarding the ability of an employee of such a facility to vouch for residents. What we said before was that you had to, the employer had to certify that the employee was in fact an employee qualified to make these identifications, but the question arose, what could possibly constitute certification? And so what we're doing, instead of saying certified, is we're saying that the employee can prove employment with a current identification card or presumably with a letter from the employer stating that the employee is, in fact, an employee of that facility. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill, do you have anyone that wishes to testify for the bill?
I believe Mr. Cooper has a few words for us, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Cooper, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition. We are an alliance of some of the state's leading civic organizations working in a nonpartisan way to expand civic participation in the electoral process and to protect our democratic institutions. Some of the organizations involved in the Voting Rights Coalition include the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, the Disability Law Center, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, the League of Women Voters, and about two dozen other organizations. when we are not here at the Capitol talking to all of you about these issues that obviously you and we care about, we are out in the community trying to register people to vote, educate people about issues, turn them out to vote in the elections. We also run an election hotline where people can call in to a 1-800 number and get their questions answered about how they can go and vote and what forms of ID they can use and to answer any concerns that they might have. And we try to work closely with both the Secretary of State's office and local elections officials in doing this. Many of the issues that are addressed in this bill are things that came to our attention through that hotline because citizens were trying to exercise their constitutionally guaranteed right to vote, and they found that there were barriers in their way. And so we are bringing those barriers to you, hoping that you can address them, because we don't believe that government should be placing unnecessary barriers in the way of people going to participate in the political process. So let me just list, if you don't mind, a couple of the issues, how they came to us, and then we brought them to Representative Hilty's attention. And some of these issues are obviously things that he's known about and worked on in the past as well. One of the issues is related to the residential facilities and the list which they supposedly in the past would have turned in 20 days prior to an election so that their employees who may not live in the precinct where the facility is located can still go and vouch for the residents there so that they would have an opportunity to register on election day. We found that that was not something that was a high priority, as you can imagine, for nursing homes or homeless shelters or battered women's shelters. They have many other things going on in their daily lives, and this is not really part of their work, and it was something that sort of slipped off the radar screen. They weren't doing it, therefore they weren't able to take advantage of this new opportunity that you all had put in place in the last few years to help the residents of their facilities participate in the political process. So we're simply proposing a different way that that could happen that wouldn't be a burden on that organization. Another example of things that came to our attention through our hotline is the residential housing list for campuses. Many of our organizations do get out the vote efforts on campuses, and registering students to vote, as you know, is always a bit of a challenge because they move at least every year, if not more often than that. In many cases, they can't take advantage of some of the systems that currently exist for election day registration because they may not have utility bills that are in their own name. They may live with many roommates. They may not have a photo ID that has a current address on it. They may only have a photo ID from their educational institution which shows their identity but doesn't have an address. So the legislature has created in the past this opportunity for colleges and universities to provide to the counties a list of students who live on campus that then can be used when they show up with their photo ID in conjunction with that to show show where they live and allow them to register on election day. We found that this was not available to students that live off campus and that seemed confusing when you're talking to students on campus, that there's that distinction between the two. And we thought it would be useful to expand it to off-campus students as well. We also found that on the issue of forms of ID that can be used to show your address when you do election day registration, there were some common sense things that that many people would call the hotline and say, hey, why shouldn't I be able to do this? It just makes sense to me. It's just common sense. One of those is the lease, which we're proposing that you add here. People who recently moved to a new address would often call the hotline and say, I moved, I don't have a current photo ID that shows my current address. I don't yet know any of my neighbors, so I'm not able to have someone come and vouch for me, but I do have this lease. I can use that, right? And we'd have to say no. Usually they would then get angry and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. If I broke my lease, I would be held responsible in court for breaking my lease. It's obviously a legal document. And we would have to say, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that. So we are proposing that be added to the list. I guess I will leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Cooper, for being here. Can you provide me and maybe the rest of the committee the full list of organizations involved with your coalition? I think that would be helpful for me. And then also, in regards to the lease component, I'm just having a lease does not necessarily prove residence. So how do you suggest that you actually prove residence? I mean, leases, you can create a lease essentially to do anything, to have somebody be able to use a conference room in a building. For example, if you have a small Main Street business on Main Street, New Prague, or somewhere else in Minnesota, you can create a lease to essentially do anything. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Wondering your thoughts on how that actually proves residency.
Mr. Cooper. Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we believe that it proves residency as well as a utility bill does, where you could obviously have additional property somewhere else and be paying utilities on that. We think that it is an indicator of what your address is, but the most important thing in terms of security, which is something that I know you're concerned about, is the fact that the person is still registering on election day. They're signing a document. They're swearing that, in fact, they are who they say they are, and they are living where they say they live, and they are committing a crime if they are doing that dishonestly, and in fact, I think should be pursued and prosecuted for that.
And then, Mr. Chairman, Representative House had a question, but he had to run out for a minute. He wanted to discuss the wireless phone bill, and the concern, I think, from what he just communicated to me, is that how does that prove residency as well?
Mr. Cooper. Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I believe cell phones are currently actually allowed under the law, and that's not a change that we're making at this time. Again, it appears that to us that is one more example of someone showing where they live to a reasonable extent in front of an election judge. But they're combining that again with swearing that they live where they say they live and committing a crime if that's not true.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question on this piece of it. The way I read the amendment, and I could be wrong, in regards to the student piece, if an organization or if an institution does not deem that information to be public information, the student must be provided. The release forms must be made available to the student. So is this essentially an opt-in, or in your view, is this an opt-out? I'm trying to understand, because later on in the language, it suggests that the student must then write a request to have their name withheld. So those two components seem to be in opposition to each other.
Mr. Cooper. Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, it was our intention that we make it clear that the state would like the colleges and universities to provide this list, that if they do have concerns about whether that data should be private or not and that they shouldn't be sharing it with the Secretary of State's office and the county elections officials, that they would then have an option to request that students sign a waiver allowing them to use it. That was our intention. I don't know if you have concerns about how that's worded in the statute. Obviously, Representative Hilty could maybe answer that.
Representative Hilty, you want to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that my reading of this is that there's actually two possibilities here, that there is both an opt-in and an opt-out. That is, if the student wishes to have their name removed from a list that will be published by the university, they can ask to have their name removed, but also if the institution is not publishing the list, they can ask to be included on a list specific to those who wish to be included. I think it reads both ways. Mr. Gehring could possibly clear that up, but I think that that's correct.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, so there is language in here that, yes, it does require institutions to have these waiver forms available for students, and then the second option is for students to submit a written request. So presumably a student could submit their own written request, or they could fill out the form, and that would constitute their written request to be excluded from the list.
Mr. Chairman, I think that reads, I think this reads confusing. And so Representative Hilty, I would be more than happy to help out or in any way, and this one I actually will help out because I do think it reads in a way that could be contradictory or confusing to some. Mr. Chairman, I do have one last question regarding the challenger component of this legislation, and this is a question for Representative Hilty. I'm trying to understand that the challengers will have to prove residency, and I'm trying to remember, and I don't recall whether people who are vouching have to prove residency.
Representative Hilty, do you want to respond, or do you want to?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, in order to vouch for someone, you have to be a registered voter in the precinct in which you're vouching. So presumably you would have proved residence at the time that you registered to vote. You would be on the rolls in the precinct in which you were vouching.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then that residency piece of that of the residential housing, I heard you say that they may be outside of their home precinct vouching for the folks in those facilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that is an exception for people in that circumstance in residential facilities, because the employees of the facility may well not reside in the precinct. But they would be the people that would know who the residents of the facility were. So that's an exception that has been in law, and this is just clarifying how they identify themselves.
All right. Mr. Cooper, you said you had a list of individuals and Resident Broad asked for it. Could you just give some of the student organizations that support this legislation? Do you have that in front of you, or can you give some for the record?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have that in front of me. We have worked closely with MPIRG in the past.
All right. What about MSUSA, Minnesota State University Student Association, or the Community College Association, the two-year associations? Are they supporters of this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether they are or not. I haven't had conversations with them about this.
All right. Do we have any of the student groups here today to testify for the bill? They're probably in class.
We would hope.
One would hope that's right. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cooper or Representative Hilty, on page 3, when you reference presenting a photo identification along with a current utility bill, this is lines 3-8 to 3-10. At the end, it says, and valid residential address in that precinct. I don't know that that's defined anywhere, and maybe I shouldn't be assuming, but that doesn't mean a P.O. box. Is that correct?
Mr. Cooper or Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, are you referring to the original bill or to the amendment?
Oh, I must be. I came in late, so I think I'm referring to the original bill. I'm sorry. Which one are we?
We're on the A1 amendment A1. Was added, Representative Emmer, I think.
Well, this may be confused. I should point out that the amendment is not a delete all amendment. It basically deleted the first two sections, but the third section of the original bill is the third and fourth section of the original bill are still part of the bill.
Okay. This is section 2.
So let's say, your question would be valid. And again, Mr. Cooper, Representative Hilty, do you want to respond to his question? Or should Mr. Gehring, you?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
I'm trying to square up where we are in the amendments.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think in the amendment to lines 2.33 through 3.3 and 3.4.
Okay. That's not, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
That's not what we're referring to. You're looking at, and I do have a question on that in a second, but you're referring to what is referenced as Section 1. Oh, no, I see what you're doing. I missed it. It's at the bottom, Mr. Chairman, where it says Section 2 on page 1. So this does apply to...
page 2 of the amendment, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, is the amended version of what appears in the original bill on page 3, at lines 3.8 through 3.10.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, so have you taken out, oh, there, down at the bottom where it says 2.34 invalid residential address, but that goes with the residential facility. Did you take out this requirement that it's a valid residential address in the precinct that was under the original version?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, no, that's on line 2.34 of the amendment.
That is right.
That's what it says.
Well, then, Mr. Chair.
Showing the individual's name and valid residential address in the precinct.
Okay, so now it gets me full circle, Mr. Chairman. The question simply was, and maybe I shouldn't be making this assumption, but I assume that means a residential address as opposed to a P.O. box. Am I correct in my assumption? And if is it an assumption or is that defined somewhere?
All right, so Rex, I remember we're back to your initial question about whether this is a P.O. box, and I'm not sure if Representative Hilty or Mr. Cooper wish to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, as far as what would be defined as a valid residential address, perhaps we should refer to Mr. Gehring. He might have a better grasp of that than either Mr. Cooper or myself.
Wise move. Mr. Gehring, doing some research on that.
Mr. Chair, I believe you cannot register using a P.O. box, but I don't have a citation in front of me. So I'll keep looking.
Representative, we'll keep researching that. Come back.
All right. Then I have another question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Hilty or Mr. Cooper, why? I listened to the questions that Representative Broad asked you about adding this lease provision. Why do you need to add a lease provision? Because it would seem to me that if you have a utility bill with your name on it, that would be evidence that you, in fact, have a lease or some other possessory interest. And if you've got a lease, you should have a utility bill. So
Representative Emmer, this was covered prior to you coming in.
But
Representative Hilty can respond to it, but it was covered.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Emmer, the short story is that this arises in large part because of an instance in the last incident in the last election, in which actually a court ruled on a challenge in Minneapolis, in which a student was a resident of a facility in which the utilities were paid as part of the rent. So the only valid piece of identification that he had to indicate that he was in fact a resident there was a lease indicating that he was leasing space there. They didn't have a utility bill because the utilities were part of the lease.
At this point, there are one or two students, is that correct, or is one? If that student wishes to come down and testify, that would... Yes, please, come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Hi, thank you. My name is Lindsay Dahl. I'm the public policy advocate for the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, MPIRG, so I'm here on behalf of students. MPIRG is the largest statewide organization that works with students, and it was founded in 1971. We're a nonpartisan organization. I represent 9 campuses, University of Minnesota Twin Cities, U of M Duluth, U of M Morris, Carleton College, Augsburg, Hamlin, McAllister, the College of St. Catharines, and the William Mitchell College of Law. So, quick background of who I am representing when I'm sitting up here. I'll make it short and I'll make it sweet. When it comes to young voters, it's the youngest demographic, it's the demographic that has the least voter turnout. And I work with college students on a daily basis. It's not that they don't want to be active. A lot of it has to do with these issues that are in front of you right now. An issue of accessibility. If students come in September, elections are in November, it doesn't give them a lot of time to get the registration, proper registration and whatnot. And, you know, some students, say they're from Montana, they live here for 4 to 6, maybe 7 years. Some students don't actually ever change their driver's license over. And they're just kind of small examples of ways that you could get thousands of college students across the state of Minnesota to the polls on Election Day and to engage those folks. So on behalf of Emperor, we fully support this bill.
Ms. Dahl, unless I missed it, you went over the University of Minnesota and private colleges. Can you speak to the Minsky institutions, too? Are they in full support of this?
I can't speak to them, but I can just speak on behalf of the colleges I'm here.
Ms. Dahl, do you know if they worked on this legislation at all? This would be the state universities, the community colleges, the technical colleges across the state. That's a sizable number of students also. And we have similar problems to the ones that Representative Hilty talked about when you're talking about identifying yourself as a resident when you're going to vote.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to those.
All right. Thank you for being here today, though. I appreciate it. Question. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was trying to work through my mind. I've got an institution, a Minsky institution, that has 11,000 students, and they're all transient. Now, how are they going to sort out where those registrations would go? Because most of them don't live in Bloomington. And then four blocks away, I have another institution that is university status. Most of their students are older in medical school, and they're, most of them, I guess, are living in that district. And then I take that puzzle in my mind, and then I go over to St. Paul, where you have Augsburg, St. Kate, St. Thomas, Hamlin, McAllister, Billy Mitchell. And now that overwhelms those precincts with voters that technically would really change redistricting when that comes to us, because all of a sudden you've got this enormous population of voters. Help me work that through my logic, or maybe I'm illogical.
Mr. Chair? Ms. Dahl, or Representative Hilty, maybe.
We'll put the redistricting question, because it's not based on voter registration. Representative Peterson is based on it's based on a census data from the and as far as where you vote, our current system is such that it's voter registration is cross-checked. It would not be possible to vote, say, you know, if you're a student in Bloomington and you actually reside in Detroit Lakes, it would not be possible for you to vote in both places, because that is cross-checked in the statewide voter registration system.
Mr. Pearson, is that?
And that happens instantaneously, the election day? I mean, that's they could go in and register on election day, and yet they live in Detroit Lakes.
Representative Peterson, we do have someone from the Secretary of State's office here that could respond to your question and to the P.O. Box question, if the Secretary of State's office wants to come down and respond to both of those. We could again have two things done at once, and another major accomplishment here.
Mr. Chair, while...
Yeah, I think... Well, come on up. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself, and if you'd address the P.O. Box question, and then the time it takes to identify whether someone has actually voted twice, or more than that.
Mr. Chairman,
please identify yourself.
Gary Poser, the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's Office. On the question of the residency and the post office box, a person cannot register using the post office box. The registration form includes a spot for the residential address and a spot for a postal address if mail cannot be delivered to their residential address. So when the postal verification card gets mailed out, we have an address to mail it to. So the identification used with the utility bill or with the lease or whatever needs to have the actual residential address, not the postal box. So the valid residential address in the precinct has to be the actual residence address on that document, to match the residential address that's on the registration form, not the postal vote.
And then the second, Representative Emery, you have a question.
Mr. Chairman, sir, but what about homeless folks? I thought, how does that work? Could somebody come in and describe where they're living And then give a P.O. box where their mail goes?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, that's correct. A person who does not have an actual house, so if they were giving a location of a bridge or something like that, they would put that as their residential address, and then they could give a postal box also on the card where mail might be delivered to them.
Representative Emmer. Mr. Poser, could you address the second question that was raised by Representative Peterson on the identity?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask the question to be repeated?
Yeah, Representative Peterson.
I'm thinking specifically of Normandale College, with an enrollment somewhere around 11,000 students from a very wide range of metropolitan area. As I understand it, the college will now have to communicate to your office the residence of all those students. I mean, how is that going to work? I mean, I don't understand how that works and how you get that communication back to a precinct that has now faced the responsibility of registering them on that day.
Mr. Poser. Mr. Chairman and Representative, I believe the language here requires the university to give us an electronic file to the Secretary of State's office of the residential addresses for all of their students, so their residential list of where they live. Our office would be responsible for taking those addresses and that electronic list, running them through the precinct binder that is part of our statewide registration system to determine which precinct that student's address lies in, and then we would separate that list by precinct and give a list to that precinct of the students whose addresses lie within their precinct.
Representative Peace.
Thank you. Then the second part of that question, what happens in St. Paul? I'm just thinking Cleveland Avenue, where you have four institutions. Do those precincts, are they getting those names now? And B, do they just get overwhelmed with the student population?
Mr. Post, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I believe right now the universities can provide, if they have a dormitory, a housing list for dormitories, where this would, right, this list would then be expanded for any students living off campus. And so the precincts right now would be already handling students trying to register on Election Day. This is just rather than them providing either a voucher or a driver's license, they would have this housing list to look at to determine if the student lived within their precinct.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm probably the only one at this table who has registered homeless people with their address being at an intersection or under a bridge, and we didn't find any who had a post office bridge or post office address or a telephone. And we won the election. It was one of the Clinton ones.
Representative Morgan.
My question's been answered, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Mr. Poser, you're still there. One of the questions that Representative Peterson had posed earlier, and you didn't respond to, was what's the turnaround time if someone does vote twice, two different locations? How long does it take for the Secretary of State to identify that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, the Election Day registrations are put into the statewide voter registration system by the counties. So after Election Day, the registration cards are input into the system. They are required to input 3% of those cards within 10 days, and they would find those. The time period in statute says registration cards from Election Day need to be input within 6 weeks of the election. Some of the larger counties allows if they can't make it within that 6 weeks, they can notify our office that they won't be done within 6 weeks. So after the larger elections, it could be like through the end of January and following the election before all of the cards are input into the system. But immediately once the card is put into the system, it's a search statewide of all of the registration records within the state, and any history that's been posted to that record, if there's already election or history for that particular election, the system would notify the person putting in the input that history already would have existed for that record.
Representative Peterson.
Maybe this is a tutorial for me. So I've registered twice. Neil W. Peterson, one address in Grand Rapids. Neil W. Peterson, one address on Cleveland Avenue. How do you know that it's the same Neil W.?
Mr. Poser, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, as part of your registration record, it also includes your name, your birth date, your driver's license or the last four digits of your social security number, and those pieces together would tie it together.
All right. Representative Nelson. I'm sorry. No, Representative Anderson.
I'm sorry. Get forgotten over here. Representative Hilty, I just had a couple of questions here, and I was looking through the language that was deleted on line on page 3, line 333. Do we still have a requirement that the operator of the residential facility has to provide the list to the county auditor of their employees within 20 days? Is that completely eliminated, or is it somewhere else in statute that is not included in this amendment? And the reason why I ask that is I'm just thinking for maintenance purposes, it would probably be helpful to the county auditors to have that list, because the new language on page 4, line 11, doesn't refer to a time frame of when they need to provide any kind of list to the auditors of who's official, who's an actual employee.
But Mr. Hilton. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is what's being changed here. You're correct. I mean, what we're deleting is the requirement to produce a list in advance, and instead the new language says the employee can identify themselves as an employee with an identification card or some form of verification from the employer at the time that they appear at polls to verify the residence of the residency of the residence of the facility.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'm just curious, you know, how the county auditors feel about something like that. I know sometimes it might be helpful for them just to have a list in advance, you know, before. I know sometimes folks change in that status. I'm just thinking it might be helpful, and considering that election judges are kind of frenzied that day in the first place, especially on the college campus when we have a lot of students coming in.
Chair Representative Anderson, perhaps Mr. Poser can address that question, but I would speculate that, in fact, the county auditors would be very happy not to have a list they have to deal with in advance.
Mr. Poser?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I would say that the county auditors would support the new proposal. The existing language is an extra part for the election judges to have to keep track of it on election day of that list and verifying with that list, versus having the staff member just show their ID to the election judge at the time they were witnessing that resident's residency and their registration.
Okay. Well, that seems odd to me, but that's all right. I do have another question, though, for you.
Representative Anderson.
And this is for Representative Hilty. I am on page 1, and I'm just curious.
In front of the bill or the amendment?
The amendment, I'm sorry. On page 1 of the amendment, and I'm just curious of the list that the campuses provide to the Secretary of State. What's the timeline in which they need to provide that to them?
Representative Hilty.
To the Secretary of State. The list to be provided to the Secretary of State, not to the Secretary.
I believe
not for the Secretary of State to provide to the county auditor.
It's at least four, on line 1.21, at least 14 days.
No, that says at least 14 days before the state or the city, the state Secretary of State shall provide the appropriate county auditor with the list. But where is there the timeline for the institutions to provide the list to the Secretary of State?
Line 1.16. No later than 45 days.
1.16. No, that's for the student's name. That's a student may submit a written request to the institution. That's regarding.
Let's go to Mr. Garrett.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there isn't a deadline for the schools to submit their list specific. The language about the 45 days is for a student to request that their name be withheld from the list. And as you said, the 14 days is for the Secretary of State to provide the county auditors with the list. So there isn't a timeline for the schools.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, then just for the sake of the Secretary of State's office, we might need to put in a timeline for the institutions to provide that list to them, just so that we're not caught flat-footed. and the institutions have clear direction when they need to get that list to them. And then just out of curiosity too, Mr. Hilty, I was wondering, when will the list be provided to the public? When will that be made available to the public?
Representative Hilty, or Mr. Poser, I guess, either one.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Poser might be better able to answer that question.
Mr. Poser.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, once that list is provided to us, our obligation, I believe, under this is to provide it to the polling place for the election judges. So I'm not sure, are you thinking that we are, when the public is, that we're providing it to the polling place? Or I don't think we would be providing it to the public themselves unless, you know, somebody requested it under some public information request.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm guessing that there will be individuals out there that will request it as a public data, and I'm just wondering when it will be made available to the public.
Mr. Poser.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, I believe our office would then be responding to any public information request within the timelines required by the request itself.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Gearing could provide guidance on this. It doesn't have to be today, but some point down the road of when, because I'm assuming it would happen at the Secretary of State level or even at the institution level, that it would be made public to the...
All right, Mr. Gearing's nodding his head. Mr. Poser, to Representative Anderson's question on the timeline for the universities, do we, in the groups that have developed this, either the University of Minnesota, the Minsky system, or the private colleges, have they have their own internal policy on this when they would provide these?
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, the current residential housing lists are just provided from the institution to the county auditors themselves, and our office hasn't been part of that. I think because of the electronic format, our office is being asked through this legislation to be compiling these lists. So I'm unsure of what the current practice between some of those institutions and their individual county auditors has been.
So, Mr. Poser, has there been any direct communication with the University of Minnesota, the Minsky system, or the private college, the private colleges of Minnesota, on how this list is going to be developed and transmitted to your office?
Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge.
Mr. Poser, that would seem to be an oversight.
Mr. Chairman, this particular language isn't coming from our office.
No, Mr. Poser, I realize that, but ultimately you're in charge of all elections, mm-hmm. and you're requiring three systems to do something. Granted, the privates are individual colleges, but the other two are rather large systems. Unless there's someone here today from any one of them that wishes to testify.
Mr. Chair, I should point out that this is that they've already been doing this. This is not a new requirement.
Right.
But I think that the point about a required date by which it would be submitted is something that I'm certainly willing to pursue, as well as the question in general about, given this requirement, how has it been working and how can we make sure that it works the way everyone would agree that it should. So I'd be happy to pursue that, Mr. Chair.
Representatively, there are some communities that have private colleges and public universities, both, where students both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some who are on this committee. Mr. Poser has a...
Who shall remain unnamed?
Mr. Chairman, I've just been handed a note here that the current student lists are being sent at least 20 days before the elections to the county auditors.
Mr. Poser, is that policy consistent through all three of those systems?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure.
All right. At some point, an answer to that probably should be provided. That would be for clarity and then for the various communities, whether it's in St. Paul or greater Minnesota, that we know when those lists are coming from the university. So, Representative... Representative Emmer, do you still have a question?
No, sir.
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, as you look at how to change this language going forward, too. I think Representative Anderson makes some very good points, but she looked at them from the Secretary of State's point of view and the college and university's point of view, and I think we should also look at it from the student's point of view. If there's no guideline on the time, we could set forth a provision for students to opt out for 45 days, but what if the system, the university system, the Minsky system, has already sent that list forward? If there's no guiding time frame from which that they have to either hold the list before they transfer it to you, I think that we could run into some problems there where a student might want to opt out, but they're already in. So I hope that we'll do that going forward. And then I did just, Mr. Chairman, want to bring up when we were talking with Representative Peterson's questions about, you know, if I vote in Detroit Lakes or register in Detroit Lakes and then register at the campus, I think I heard Representative Hilty say it's just not possible. And as I heard the gentleman from the Secretary of State, it certainly would be possible. It's illegal, but it certainly is possible. So I just wanted to make sure that it's not an improbability. It's not a good thing, obviously, but I don't think it's fair to say it's impossible.
Representative Hilton. Mr. Chair, Representative Brudd, if I said impossible, that's not actually what I meant. It's certainly possible to do that, but as you pointed out, it's not legal to do that. And as Mr. Posier, I think, made clear, the likelihood of you being caught doing it is pretty great in the current system, so that I think that it's pretty risky to commit a felony just to be able to cast a vote at two different places, and I don't think that it's very likely to occur in any intentionally on any grand scale.
Representative Brock. All right. Ms. Frazier, do you want to add something? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Beth Frazier, the Director of Governmental Affairs from the Secretary of State's office. I don't have anything to add at this point. Mr. Poser had to leave, and so I'm here to answer any questions from to the Secretary of State's office. That's with my ability.
Thank you. Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, to address a question you asked a while ago about the colleges and universities, the University of Minnesota and the private colleges, in our conversations with them in the past, we have consulted with them about this list, and they've raised three types of concerns, which we hoped we were addressing in this legislation. One of them was that a few of them had concerns about the privacy of the data, and that's why the provisions in there about the waiver. One of the concerns that they raised was that the format of the list not be burdensome for their administration, and that's why the provision is in here that they would have to agree to the format of the list. And the third concern was that they not be put in a position where they have to actually take their student housing lists and divide them out and figure out who's in what precinct or in what county, which is why the Secretary of State's office has kindly agreed to do that processing for them. So we've tried to address the three concerns that they have raised in the past.
All right. Representative.
Just the question, I guess, to the Secretary of State's office. Do you see any additional costs to the Secretary of State's office in this bill?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, yes. I think that bringing the Secretary of State's office into the process of sorting through the lists and redistributing them would involve cost on our part. So I do think there is a fiscal implication.
All right. Well, then. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification from, I think, the author, but Representative Peterson's example of Normandale had me looking more carefully at the language on 1.8, 1.9 in terms of the 10 miles of the institution campus. Language that's been replaced with a county or city where one of the more institutions' campuses are located. I think the spirit here is in essence the people who are living in the dorms or in off-campus housing directly adjacent. I'm just wondering which, in the language here, it's unclear about which trumps, the county or the city. So under the Normandale example, we could be dealing with Hennepin County rather than, I believe it's Bloomington, right, Representative Peterson? But just if Representative Hilty, you could maybe calm my concern just about that ambiguity, excuse me.
Representative Hilty.
Or,
Representative
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
I can clarify, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you slim that question down a little bit?
The existing language is we're requiring the list of students enrolled in the institution and residing in the institution's housing, formal dormitories, or within 10 miles of the institution's campus. So off-campus housing, short drive, very common thing on our college campuses and around. I have classmates at William Mitchell, where I'm currently a student as well, who fit this definition very well. But the question is, are they students who are residing in the institution's housing or within the county or city where the institution's campus are located? So in William Mitchell's case, is that Ramsey County? Or in Normandale College, is it Hennepin County? Or is it the very city? I just wonder if that is indeed a concern, that we're casting a wide net here and requiring a lot of more information to be sent to the Secretary of State than under the existing statute. And if one might trump the other.
Representative Hiltier and Ms. Frazier.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I've taken this to mean what it says, the county or city. I think that it would include both. I mean, every city is within a county. So I don't see how I could not include residents of the county in which the institution was located.
Representative Kalin, that may be the best answer you're going to get.
And it may be, and I'm happy to speak with the author individually about the issue and to clarify.
Mr. Chair, we'll think about that. If that needs any clarification, I'd be happy to clarify it.
All right.
Find language to do that.
Is there any further discussion to House File? I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Just one more, Chair, and just Representative Hilty, I just hope you know I do support what you're trying to get at here today, and I think that just with a couple little fixes we'll be good to go. I did want to address, before we have it leave here today, Representative Broad's concerns on the two kind of the mixed message as far as the student data. And I'm looking at line 1 point. On page 1, line 12, and changing, if we can change that language so that we have it on the word that says authorizing, change that to prohibiting the institution, and then delete to and insert from, and then on provide, change provide to providing. And that way it jives with the language that's just below that says, rather than having in one case the student opts in and the other case the student opts out, it makes it just a complete where the student takes the effort to opt out of having the name included.
Representative Anderson, is that a suggestion or
that's not? That's an amendment I would like
to
make.
All right. So let's go slowly here and have Mr. Gehring actually tell us what you just did. He doesn't know.
Sure yet. She's with the repeat.
Representative Anderson, slowly, so Mr. Gehring can get it and staff can get this amendment, okay. Which is not a suggestion.
Okay.
All right.
Page 1, line 12, delete...
Of the amendment. All right.
Delete authorizing, insert prohibiting, then on the word 2, delete the word 2, insert from. On the word provide, delete the letter E and insert ING.
Mr. Gehring, why don't you repeat this so we know how it would read?
Mr. Chair, so let me read that whole sentence to make sure this is accurate, which would start on line 1.10. Institutions that do not consider student addresses to be public information under applicable federal and state privacy laws must make release forms available to all students prohibiting the institution from providing the address to the Secretary of State.
So let's go to the sponsor of the bill, Representative Hilton.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that just totally changes the character of this provision, which is intended, in fact, to say that students
that there's a mechanism here for students whose name would not appear on the list to ask that their name be on the list. And the amendment would say that that's not possible, but I think that considering that this is an opt-in provision for students and all we're doing is asking the institutions that would not automatically provide those names to provide a form in which the student could ask to be included. If I understand the amendment, and I think I do, I would oppose it because it is not in keeping with the intention of this provision.
All right. Any further discussion on the Anderson amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Representative Gale.
I think that I appreciate the opportunity. Although it's not absolutely 100% crystal clear from the language, it is reading it through again that there are two schemes here. One is where the data is public at the institution and the students can opt out, and that is line 1.10. Excuse me. That's line 1.14 is the students opting out in the public data situation. The other scheme is where the institution considers to be private data and the students can opt in, and that's line 1.10 that Representative Anderson is seeking to amend. What Representative Anderson's amendment would do is actually get rid of that opt-in option for students who want to make it easier. So it's having read through it several times, that's exactly what's happening, is this scheme of opt-in, of public, students can opt out, private, students can opt back in. And the amendment would actually defeat the purpose of that scheme in language.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
What is confusing to me is you look at line 10 and you read through that entire sentence. It says the student first must authorize the institution to provide the address. Okay, but when you get to line 14, then it says a student may submit a written request to the institution to withhold the student's name. So that's confusing to me because first you're saying the student has to authorize it in the first place, and then you're saying, oh, by the way, they need to submit a written request later on to withhold their name. Well, they wouldn't have had to withhold their name if they had to authorize it in the first place. Do you see how it's not jiving? The language does not jive at all.
Mr. Cooper, do you want to respond to that? You look like you're ready to pounce on something.
Mr. Chairman, I want to say that Representative Kalin is correct in interpreting the language, which may not be entirely clear about the fact that there are two schemes. He's correctly interpreted it as representing, being intended to represent two different schemes, one where the university does not intend for the information to be public, and then allowing students to opt in and have their name put on this list, even though the university otherwise would not share their name, and a separate scheme for everyone else where the data is already public and the information would be provided, and where students may not wish to have their information provided and they could opt out.
Perhaps scheme's unfortunate here, maybe opportunity to vote or opportunity or not vote would be a better way of putting it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilke, please.
Mr. Chair, I think that my interpretation squares with Mr. Cooper's, but I think that there is possibly some confusion here. I don't think that Representative Anderson has any different intent, actually, than I do regarding this. And I think rather than try to amend this when there's still does seem to be some question about what is intended and what the language actually means. If Representative Anderson would be agreeable to just work with me on language that does clarify this as this goes forward, I think that would be preferable to trying to fix it at this point.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to do that. I guess when I look at institutions, I'm guessing that most of the institutions will consider this data to be private. And so I'm assuming that they are going to make that assumption, especially
I'm not that far removed from college, and I know that different institutions that I've had the opportunity to work with in the past have been very adamant that their student data is private, and that goes from the INSCU system to the university system.
So, Representative Addison, you're withdrawing your amendment.
I will withdraw my
amendment. Representative Addison withdraws her amendment. To the bill as amended, any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hilty renews his motion on House File 1223 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Finance Committee with the intent that it would go to state government finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next item on the agenda is House File 492, Representative Hawes.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative
Maury. Mr. Chair, while Representative Hawes gets ready, I would like to take a moment, if I could, to recognize some members of the audience here. It's Burnsville High School Day at the State Capitol. We have some people from the government classes and the college and the school's economics classes who have come down to watch the process and track their bills. Representatives here in the room and throughout the state office building may be meeting and chatting about their bills with these students who have been tracking their bills in class over the last 5 or 6 weeks, and I'd just like to recognize them up there. Thank you for coming down today.
So, students, could you stand for us, please, so we know who you are? There you are. Representative Hawes, I will move the House File 492 be recommended to pass. It's my understanding this is going to go to the General Registry. Is that correct?
We certainly, with your wisdom, with the committee's wisdom, I think it would fit there. It would be debatable in the bill, if you notice line items, 211 to 213 has some notes on finance, but I think they're so minor. But if it's the desire of the chair and desire of the committee, I'd be willing to go to finance with it also. But I think it fits on the general register.
Representative Hawes, I'm not sure you answered my question.
Okay,
the motion would be to send it to the general register.
No, we'll send it to the general register, sir.
Is that if there is a fiscal impact, it will go somewhere else.
Thank you very much, sir.
Representative, hang on just one second. Representative Haas, what I'm going to do is withdraw my initial motion about general registry, and I'm going to recommend House File 492 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance.
Okay.
If there is a cost to this, rather than send it to the floor and have it pulled back by one of the finance chairs, and I'm not even sure which one would do it, but there's a long list and it multiplies the ability to pull this back. Let's just send it to finance and see where it would go if there is a cost. If they say there isn't any, then you're covered when it gets to the floor. So with that, Representative Hawes, the bill is before us. Please explain your bill.
Mr. Chair, we do have an amendment. Can we
the A1 amendment?
A1 amendment, and would we have that introduced in order to put the bill in the order I'd like to heard?
I'll move the A1 amendment to your bill, and is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? It seems like it's more of a... Well, let me ask you, is there anything substantive in this amendment, or are we just clarifying?
I think it brings better balance. Other people would probably disagree. It's kind of like on a little teeter-totter. But I think it's a very tolerable and a good amendment, and I suggest you pass it.
All right. With that, I will move the A1 amendment be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Representative, how's your bill? Should be in the order you want it, so please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for your wisdom on where to send this next. People kind of know about the short-term felon.
situation because a couple years ago there was a shifting of the short-term felons to the county jails, and the money didn't flow very well with it. Matter of fact, it's now at $10 to a $55 cost. And then that magnified our knowledge and magnified the problems. As we fight and cry on the county level and get this back into the state paying for a larger portion of that in the county, and that is probably going to happen. You notice that there's bills flowing, and in the governor's bill there was increasing it to $30. Then people start saying on the state side, you know, this isn't exactly what we should be doing. Now, it's easy enough when you're paying $10 on a $55 bill to say it's tolerable. But as you start paying more, then you recognize the program is not what it should be. We have state prisoners in county jails without the state actually having met them or booked them in. We have programs that probably shouldn't be taking place, that should be taking place, maybe in some county jails, but not in all. And so we really do have to grab a hold of this. One of the portions of this, and I don't know if I captured it in the spirit, but it should be in the spirit of the committee that studies this, the hierarchy should be with the Department of Correction. And they should bring these players in to get enough wisdom of that system. We sometimes get so segregated that we really don't know everything about our own system. And with that, then, we should have a report back to say how these should be taken care of, if they're in county jails, what the rate should be. And about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a recommendation for a regional jail structure for short-term felons, which was, I thought, a very wise a path to be going on, but I didn't want to give what I think is the solution. I wanted, with the leadership of Sheriff's County and the Department of Correction, to get enough input to give us the direction that we should be taking this. I think the system is broken, and I think this is an opportunity to repair it. Because we have good staffs on all levels, it hasn't been an embarrassment yet, but it has the potential to be. I do have a witness here today, John Tuma, would you like to take testimony from him?
Representative Tuma, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Inter-County Association. It's a pleasure to be in front of your committee, Mr. Chairman, and call you Mr. Chairman again. So it is true that this was a 2003 budget crisis fix that the state came up with to help a very depleted corrections budget by shifting state felons to county jails that have less than 6 months to serve. I want to basically point out to you that this is not petty thieves. Okay, these are serious felons. They are a difficult population for county jails to manage. What you're talking about is an individual who has been sentenced under the guidelines, should have gone to prison, but the judge has put him on probation under terms, probably served 6-7 months in the county jail and is out on probation and is supposed to not do things. And he keeps doing them again and again and again, and finally the judge says, I've had enough. I'm executing your sentence. You're going to be punished. He is literally slapping him on the hand. This is an individual that goes into our county jail that has nothing to gain by behaving. Typically, when he started with the sentence, he had 6 months, and if he behaved, he got out. There's no motivation for most of these individuals at this time to behave, and it becomes a very difficult population to manage within our facilities. They're not there to be on work release. They're not a normal individual that a jail typically has to handle. They are a serious felon. They could be anywhere from a sex offender to a drug dealer to individuals who've been involved in assaults. These are not your pleasant individuals, and so it becomes a difficult population for our counties to handle. We have taken them because we understand the state is saying to us that it's difficult for them to handle also, to take these guys back, send them up to St. Cloud for a 3-month orientation, and then try to get them programming, which they have no time to get them programming. And so we understand this is also difficult from the state's level. And so we want to work with the state to find a way to handle these. We have had communications with the department. They've indicated willingness to talk to us, and hopefully this bill will just disappear by the end of session if we can work a resolution out with the Department of Corrections and the county associations, along with the AMC, with the county attorneys, and also the Sheriff's Association are open and willing to talk on a different way of handling this if the dollars are available, which they appear to be. And so this is just a common sense way to handle it, and maybe it'll be taken care of before the session is over with some good common sense. But in the alternative, we think it's wise for the legislature to instruct the commissioner to put this group together in case something isn't worked out by the end of session. And so I think Representative Hawes's bill is a wise statement that if this is not resolved by the end of session, you guys must sit down and figure out how to handle this population in a more wise and effective way for both the state and county levels. This has been about a $19 million shift under your property taxes, direct shift to your property taxpayers. And so we need to find a better way of handling it. Your property taxpayers should not be paying for state felons, and we need to find a more effective way to do that. And so we're exploring that, and we'll continue to explore that, and appreciate your consent to Haas's bill to require that to be done if something isn't resolved in this session. Thank you.
Representative Kahn may have a suggestion on a minor change to your bill. So, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I'm embarrassed because I think I just put in a task force bill, and I'm not sure I did it correctly. We discovered at one point, in January 15th isn't too bad. We used to write January 1st for those, but, you know, February 1st is kind of a much more humane day for a report to the legislature. You know, people can kind of take Christmas and New Year's off. So just make that January 15th to February 1st.
Mr. Chair. She's looking at page 2, line 2.6, delete January 15th and insert February 1st. Representative Hawes, what's your reaction to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I would consider that a friendly amendment, and I appreciate your wisdom. I really am happy that people are saying that this should not have to be done, that these organizations and these governmental units should be able to sit down and do that without a direction from us. And if that's what they need is this, if they really need to have this, that's really great. But I'd be excited about some synergy here and having to do it without us saying you've got to. Thank you very much. I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Unless there's any further discussion to the Kahn amendment, Representative Kahn moves to amend House File 492 on line 2.6, page 2, deleting January 15th and inserting February 1st. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Discussion to the bill. Any further discussion to the bill? Anyone else wish to testify on the bill, for or against? Seeing none, then I will renew my motion that House File 492, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 965.
Chair Kowalski.
Representative McFarland, welcome to the committee. What I'm going to do is move House File 965, be recommended to pass, and be sent to the General Registry. So with that, the bill is before us. Okay. Representative, do you wish to present your bill?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair. What you have in front of you is House File 965-DE1 is what you should be looking at. This is different than was originally written. This is an amendment that was done in the Senate when they heard this bill, and so therefore it was passed unanimously, and I wanted to include that in this presentation today. First, I wanted to give just a little bit of background. The reason I brought this forward as an introduction of a bill is because I had a constituent in my district who had been an election judge in 2004, and in 2006, because of changes to the law, was not able to be an election judge. So because of that, myself and Senator Rummel decided to present this bill, and we have a lot of backing from the League of Minnesota Cities, the Township Association, League of Minnesota, League of Women Voters, and other supporters. If I could, I'd like to defer to...
Okay, Representative McCarlin, you're working off the DE1 amendment, is that correct?
Yes.
Representative McCarlin, what I'm going to do is move the DE1 amendment, and we're going to put that in first. So I move that House File 965 be amended using the DE1 amendment. And all those, because Representative McCarlin has already explained it, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. And then, Representative McCarlin, do you want to proceed with the description with this amendment, or do you want the A1 amendment then also put on?
We'll do the A1 amendment also.
All right.
First.
Members, there's an A1 amendment. So, Representative McFarland, would you explain the A1 amendment? I will move the amendment, but before we vote on it, would you explain it, please?
Could I defer to Kent Solm, please?
Yes, by all means. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Solom. I represent the Minnesota Association of Townships. The A1 amendment is an attempt, an issue that has been a top priority for our association for a couple of years, and we've worked very closely now with the Secretary of State's office and others involved with the election process to clarify that for a township election, which is completely nonpartisan, there's no endorsements that go on, there's no primary process, it is strictly a small, you know, usually one or two candidate election, that the need for partisan judges is removed completely. We're still required to have the proper party balance for any state election, but for our standalone March elections that have no ties whatsoever to parties, this amendment would exempt the township elections from the need for party balance. It does one other small item, and that is, this amendment is modeled after existing law for school districts, and it inserts into that provision of law, which is 205A.10, the new citation being created by the general bill, and so that way the cross-references work. I was contacted by Mr. Gehring just before the start of the hearing that on line 1.6, there's a citation to Minnesota Statute 206.64 Subdivision 2, and that same citation appears on 1.18, and apparently that statute has now been repealed, and so I believe it would be appropriate that we could strike that from the amendment.
All right, why don't we have Mr. Gehring explain that. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Section 206.64 Subdivision 2 was repealed in 1997. So the cross-references don't have any effects. There's nothing there to cross-reference. So I believe that the amendment or the change would be on line 1.6, we'd be deleting the reference to 206.64 Subdivision 2, and then on line 1.18, we'd be striking 206.64 Subdivision 2.
Mr. Gang, can I incorporate that change into my amendment? We haven't voted on this yet, so...
I believe so.
All right. Is the author?
Yes.
All right. So Representative McBrown's fine with that. I will incorporate those changes then into the amendment. Does everyone have those changes? Mr. Gehring, Mrs. Anderson, you got it? Mr. Gehring, go through one more time exactly what we're going to delete here.
So line 1.6, we're deleting 206.64 Subdivision 2. And line 1.18, we're striking 206.64 Subdivision 2.
All right. Staff, everybody have this? All right. I'll incorporate that into the amendment then. All right. The amendment is still before us. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Amendment prevails. Representative, your bill should be in the order that you wish it.
Thank you. At this time, Chair, I would like to introduce Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities. I've also asked all of my testifiers to be very brief today.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities. I work with city election officials, and we all together work with county and our state election officials. This bill that you have before you, the delete all, I just wanted to address a couple of highlights of that amendment and what it particularly addresses. First of all, modifies duties that we have at the local level for appointing election judges, giving us some more discretion in use of the list that we get from the major political parties, so that if we have a situation where, for instance, a major political party is the dominant party and we have many more people from that list than we have people from another, we can go to our other sources to try to find additional people from the other political party, because what this does do is retain the political party balance at the polling place, so that because we have not deleted any of the statutes that require election judges of two different major political parties to either assist a voter, initial ballots, and do other duties at the polling place on election day. That is retained, but what we have put in here is that where we have the opportunity to go to a larger pool of folks to solicit their interest in serving, we can now, we could, if you agree to this, appoint persons who are not affiliated with any of the major political parties. At this point, we have two, so that they may also serve. We find this, and if you have, I think, in your packet, the letter from the City of Rochester about the difficulties they have there, this underscores this has been a problem for some time, and it is becoming worse as many of our election judges are getting older, are in need of new recruits, and we want to open the pool to people who simply, for their own personal reasons, have no interest in and don't want to be identified with affiliation with any political party. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, I believe we have just one or two other people.
I'd like to introduce Grace Walker-Lawrence from the City of White Bear Lake.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Grace Walker-Rowett, Supervisor of Licensing and Elections for the City of White Bear Lake, and I just want to concur with Ann Higgins as far as her perspective. As an administrator of city elections, state elections, federal, and as well as school district elections, I want to assure you that the integrity of the elections is in place. The majority of the responsibilities of an election judge is nonpartisan. Our election judges are very committed to go forth and perform those. So that is in place. The only political affiliation is in four instances. One is which you assist a voter at the booth, you have curbside voting, accepting absentee ballots, and also duplicating any damaged absentee ballots. Those are still in place. That still ensures the integrity of the elections and also the party affiliation. So that piece is still in place. All we're asking is the flexibility to have more opportunity to engage more election judges in the process. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
I'd like to call Adi Wickstrom from the Minnesota League of Women Voters.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Adi Wickstrom, and I'm the webmaster for the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. During the election season, my primary responsibility is to provide election information to voters throughout the state on our website. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you this morning. I speak on behalf of House File 965. The League of Women Voters believes that democratic government depends on the informed and active participation at all levels of government. We also support improvements in election laws regulating election procedures. Requiring a citizen to divulge his or her party in order to serve as an election judge excludes some from participating in this fundamental part of our election process. There are some duties that require election judges from two political parties for partisan elections, and we support that. However, we believe that most duties can be performed without party designation. Passage of this bill will allow more people to serve as election judges and make it easier for many local jurisdictions to find election judges to serve. A substantial number of registered voters in Minnesota either consider themselves a member of a minor party or are swing voters who do not belong to either party. Our office staff receives numerous phone calls and email messages with complaints from people who want to serve as election judges but are not a member of a party. Why should they be denied this opportunity to serve as an election judge? I had a conversation last month with an executive of a major Minnesota corporation. He would like his company to encourage his employees to be election judges. It's a great idea, but I warned him that this would be much easier for him to recruit volunteers if they did not have to give a party designation.
Being an election judge would also be a wonderful opportunity for high school seniors or college political science majors, but they may not be comfortable in stating a party preference. Minnesota does not require voters to register with a party choice or to designate a party when voting in the state primary election. For many voters, there is no way to know what party they actually belong to. By requiring all election judges to declare party affiliation, we are excluding many from serving. Why should a citizen willing to serve the community be denied this opportunity? LWVMN asks for your support of 965, and we thank Representative McFarland for sponsoring it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions?
And my last witness is Diane Peterson, one of my constituents that I had referred to earlier.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I am Diane J. Peterson. I live in White Bear Lake, and I am a constituent of Representative Carol McFarland. She agreed to author this bill when I asked for her help to remove a barrier to my ability to serve as an election judge. I was trained by Ramsey County Elections to be an election judge, but since I am not currently affiliated with a major party, nor do I wish to affiliate with a major party, I am not allowed to serve. A few years ago, when I was affiliated with a major party, I served as an election judge in St. Paul. The opportunity to serve in Minnesota government is very precious to me. Please pass this bill so that I and others like me will not be discriminated against in hiring due to our political creed. I view the current law as employment discrimination by the state. It clearly subverts the principle of equal opportunity employment. House File 965 removes the discrimination. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for your service, too. Any further testimony for or against the bill? Representative Hilton.
Well, Mr. Chair, very briefly, I would speak in favor of this bill. In my experience in working with elections officials all over the state for the past few years, that this is really one of the major issues that we confront virtually everywhere in the state. It's getting more and more difficult to recruit election judges. This is removing the major impediment to that, and I would just urge members to support the bill.
We may have a whole field of potential judges right up there. Hopefully. Any other discussion? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 965 as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Before we adjourn, may I approve the minutes? Move to approve the minutes of Thursday, March 1.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. With that, meeting is adjourned.